This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me today in the Scanner studio is Professor Brent Morris of the University of South Carolina at Beaufort. And on the line is Michael Allen, who is the Community Partnership Specialist with the National Park Service in Charleston. And today we're going to talk about the National Park Service National Historic Reconstruction Studies Project, which means studying the era in American history after the Civil War, generally considered, particularly here in South Carolina, from 1865 to 1877, although with the South Carolina connection, we can go all the way back to 1861 with the occupation of Beaufort and Port Royal. So, Michael, this initiative with our discussion with the Park Service really began almost at the turn of the millennium, did it not?
Yes, you're correct, sir. It was in December of 2000, I guess in the latter days of the Clinton administration, that the outgoing Secretary of the Interior, Bruce Babbitt, and Dr. Eric Foner, I guess, who's well known in the subject and time matter of Reconstruction, brought a number of people together in the Beaufort area with one simple request that the Park Service undertake a study and conversations with the community to potentially look at establishing a National Park Service site in the Beaufort area, reflecting and chronicling the history of Reconstruction.
Brent, let's talk about why Beaufort might be the site. Some really start Reconstruction with 1861 and the capture of Beaufort Port Royal in November by Union forces, and as the late Willie Lee Rose wrote in her famous book, Rehearsal for Reconstruction, the Port Royal Experiment. So how about talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. The Battle of Port Royal Sound in November the 7th of 1861 was the first big military engagement that resulted in the taking of considerable property by the Union from the Confederate forces. And it was a pretty quick battle. After the battle on November the 7th, on November the 8th, the plantation owners began what historians have called the Great Skedaddle, which was their running towards the mainland and towards Columbia and just as far as they could run, leaving behind approximately 8,000 to 10,000 of their former slaves. The way that the Port Royal experiment sort of developed after that, it was a time period when there was cotton ripening in the fields, 8,000 to 10,000 good, able-bodied workers to get the cotton out of the fields. And Secretary of the Treasury Salmon P. Chase realized that this would be a great opportunity to, A, get some money for the Union war effort, but B, possibly even helping his presidential ambitions for 1864, to use the Port Royal experiment as a way to prove that African Americans could work for payment, that they didn't have to be compelled to work, that they could be receptive to an education, that freedom, when it was accomplished after the Civil War, would not be something that was a wasted effort, but that could actually be something towards the great benefit of the United States.
Okay, and this actually was, as we say today, a joint private-public enterprise, because most of the workers in the Port Royal experiment were religious figures civic-minded folks, particularly the school teachers, primarily female, coming from Philadelphia and Boston, and they were privately funded. But they had to work with and sometimes fight with the military forces in Beaufort.
Right. It seemed a lot of times that they were kind of at odds. But a lot of Northern reformers looked down into Port Royal and saw this as a great opportunity. So organizations like the American Missionary Association funded just boatloads of reformers. And they were called kind of derisively the Gideonites because they all came with their Bibles. A lot of these Gideonites, a lot of these reformers were the most effective teachers that were down here. And they had to sort of go about their, what they considered sort of their social and moral programs at the same time that the military was operating a legitimate operation in Port Royal Sound area. But the reformers really intended the Port Royal experiment to be almost like a second founding of a city on a hill. They wanted to create this example that the rest of the nation could look to of success. This is what America can look like, a true biracial democracy after the end of this Civil War. Just look to the example of the Port Royal experiment, and there you will see what America can really be if it's true to its founding ideals of liberty and democracy and freedom.
They had many of them very noble goals, but if you look at, again, going back to Professor Rose's book and slave narratives, a lot of those reformers moved into the big house and began to act like it was theirs.
They did. There's a hint of paternalism that sort of was a cloud over everything. There was discussion of the people that they were educated was often, from the perspective of, we are here to help you. What can we do for you? And it was, in a lot of ways, the reformers were there to help themselves, to make themselves feel good about what it was they were doing. The goals they had in mind were high, they were great, but at the same time, there was this constant friction, it seemed. And that friction between the paternalism of the reformers also sort of coincided with the need of the Treasury Department and then eventually the War Department to make some money in all of this. So there were a lot of really good intentions that were difficult to achieve, and there were frustrations all throughout.
But on bottom line, most people do consider the Port Royal experiment to have been a success.
It was. Overall, you can look at it as a great example of what the freedmen would be able to do. They would work for a wage if given the opportunity. They eventually came to see Sea Island cotton not as the slave crop that they saw it as before the Civil War, but as something that could give them a route to personal economic advancement. And they looked at education, of course, as one of the prime things that they hoped to get with freedom. Education had been, or teaching a slave to read and write in South Carolina, had long been illegal. And at this point, they had the opportunity to learn to read, to learn to write, to learn enough to help themselves in negotiating contracts with landowners. So education was something that was a definite bonus that came out of this. And the public education system in America really had its start with the Port Royal experiment.
Michael Allen, when the Park Service began this initiative, you're focusing on more than just the Port Royal experiment, right? Port Royal happens to be a very logical, almost convenient site to have something like this, certainly with Penn Center just down the road. But what are the overall plans looking at this? I mean, Reconstruction was southern-wide, south-wide.
Well, as opposed to our previous engagement, where we did specifically and exclusively focus in the Port Royal, Beaufort, Hilton Head area, our current journey, if I refer to it in that manner, we are looking at the South as a whole. And so we made some decisions very early on in this planning phase. And that was, what's our area that we will be looking at and discussing with individuals and reaching out to learn more about Reconstruction? And so, in effect, we're looking at the entire South, Southeast, from Virginia to Texas, as our working canvas. And so our plan and our strategy is reaching out to organizations, groups, entities, federal, state, and local that we have come in contact with or been connected with that at the present time involve or engage in history relating to Reconstruction.
Reconstruction was different in virtually every state. How do you plan to, or the Park Service plan, to interpret this? I mean, are you going to create new sites that might be identified with Reconstruction, we've already mentioned Port Royal or Promised Land up in Greenwood County? There were similar settlements, Lincolnville. Or are you going to work with local historical societies and provide content and information? I'm trying to get my hands on how this initiative is going to work.
I think you're looking for the end product.
Okay.
Yeah, the track that we're on is multi-level. As I shared earlier, our first tier is actually canvassing the entire Southeast to secure information about building sites, locations, communities, and cities that's associated with that time in our American experience. And we're doing it in a way that would allow us to connect with a lot of organizations, which we will be able to assist or provide information or give them guidance into how they can articulate their history. I'll give you a case in point. We're learning about many communities and cities that were established during Reconstruction. And because of that, or communities, through the results of this work, that may be a catalyst for these communities to potentially erect historic markers as a way of recognizing their history. Or other entities or organizations may desire to take the information we've gathered to help communities or organizations perhaps nominate sites to the National Register for Historic Places. or depending on the level of the structure that we may find, it may be apropos to maybe consider nominating to a National Historic Landmark. So that's one way the results of this study can be utilized by the citizens, you know, of the country. Secondly, we're developing some tangible products that will also help educate the American public about this time in American experience. Within this month, we should be publishing an official National Park Service handbook on Reconstruction, which had been underway for a good part of this year. And so that's going to allow us to also share with the public, you know, the essence of Reconstruction. Even from an educational perspective, we're looking to develop curriculum-based activities that students can use, perhaps within a school setting, or even developing some type of brochure that can be secured from historic sites around the Southeast. And so we're looking at this in multiple ways that the benefit as a result of our experience that we all can share in. Now, you did ask a very pointed question about a National Park Service site. I really can't speak to that because the effort of this goal is not really, quote, tilted in that way. And so if something, as you just described, were to come to light, that will have to be something based on, you know, political conversations as well as community engagement and output. But so far as our engagement, that's not a part of what we're looking to try to help. But perhaps the work that we're doing might can assist that if that comes to bear.
What is the title of the publication that's forthcoming now that you said y'all have completed work on?
If I remember, I think it's The Era of Reconstruction. And let me add some clarity to that, because early on you talked about, quote, the years of Reconstruction, historically or generally 1865 to 1877. Again, we've made, I think, a very bold decision to really look from 1861 to about 1898. And some folks have asked, why are we looking so early and so late? But we're doing that in a manner to make sure we can really capture, you know, the breadth and scope of Reconstruction. I know historically we were taught in school 1877, that's the end. But there are other activities and elections and people involvement and engagement, even up to, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson. So we may be out of the box in thinking that way, but we hope we can provide, you know, folks a better understanding of the whole era of Reconstruction.
All right. I'm going to give this over to Brent, but I certainly understand the 1861, and actually here in South Carolina, the 1890s is certainly viable as well. I might stop it at 1895 here, but as you said, you've got Plessy versus Ferguson, which is a couple of years later. Brent?
Yeah, I agree. I think, Michael, you're not so much out of the box if you actually look at what historians have sort of been talking about recently, and that is one thing. There's a big gap between what historians have been talking about sort of to themselves, as historians do,
and not all historians,
but what the public knows and how the public understands Reconstruction. 1861 works perfectly, I think. It's you can start it just a couple months after the beginning of the Civil War. Really, you know, some people have said, you know, the first shot that was fired at Fort Sumter marked the end of slavery. And if you look at it that way, then the end of slavery, of course, ushers in the era of Reconstruction. The standard cutoff there at 1877, it works in a lot of ways. 1877 was when the contested presidential election of 1876 was finally resolved. And the end result of this, sort of in a nutshell, was the end of federal Reconstruction in America, the withdrawal of federal troops who had been propping up Reconstruction governments in South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana. But beyond that, you can actually see Reconstruction sticking around. It had incredible staying power in a lot of ways, especially in places like Beaufort, South Carolina. Beaufort had a very large black majority. And even when the support of the federal government was sort of taken away, the large black majority in Beaufort, these are all people who now can vote and run for and have office if they win. These are people that have to be dealt with. They have to be reckoned with. So even though the Democratic Party sort of comes into power in the state of South Carolina, and the Democratic Party is the party that's doling out the patronage positions. They're forced to, in order to get anything done in places like Buford, they're forced to work with African Americans and with Republicans. So what happens in Buford is the formation of this fusion government, and you see this in places like Buford. You see a successful fusion government,
Georgetown,
Wilmington, North Carolina, other places like that. So the results of Reconstruction, the enfranchisement of African Americans, the ability of, you know, usually former slaves to hold public office, that extended well beyond 1877 in a lot of places. Walter had mentioned 1895 as a possible end point. 1895 was the point at which South Carolina called a new constitutional convention, or Ben Tillman called a new constitutional convention, and the result of which was the general disfranchisement of African Americans. Right. But the final election before that, 1892, was a Reconstruction election. You were still dealing with the 1868 Constitution. African Americans were still standing for office. And you can even push it maybe into the 20th century in Buford, at least. Robert Smalls was still, he was still a public official. He was still doing his job as a result of the enfranchisement that sort of came from Reconstruction.
The three of us know who Ben Tillman was and why the 1895 Constitutional Convention was called. Elected governor by 1895, he was actually United States Senator,
right.
But he was the political power in South Carolina, and the effort was to disenfranchise African Americans because they could potentially be the swing vote between two blocks of whites in South Carolina, the conservatives led by Wade Hampton and the reformers, as Tillmanites were called. And in one gubernatorial election, the Hampton conservatives actually appealed for the black vote, and that was anathema to many white South Carolinians, and so that's why you have the new Constitutional Convention of 1895.
Right, right.
But ironically, Tillman supports a black congressman, a Republican, because he is basically a populist in terms of the free coinage of silver, which gets too complicated. But he was that made him more acceptable than a Cleveland Goldbug, Grover Cleveland Goldbug Democrat.
Right.
So this is South Carolina.
It is.
And what I want to add to that, guys, is, you know, again, because this discussion is who we are as people, as historians, it's important, I think, not only for South Carolinians, but for Americans to really have a understanding of the complications of Reconstruction, as you just described. And I often say we live today as a result of the residue of Reconstruction and how certain fundamental decisions are being made today or certain parts of our government that exist today have its tentacles in that time period. But if you are aware of it, then you would know that you're part of something or something is happening around you that's been going on since Reconstruction.
There are some interesting Reconstruction monuments, if you will, in New Orleans, a monument to a mob that attacked African-American office holders. There are museums that are dedicated to the red shirts and the Klan. So it's a very complicated part of our history, and sometimes it's one that people just want to sweep under the rug. You mentioned the voting, and we talk about the voting, but until the 1895 and the actual implementation of Jim Crow in South Carolina, public accommodations in Charleston and Columbia were open. Eating establishments, theaters, streetcars, what have you.
Yeah. The connection between today's world also and what happened in Reconstruction is really, really appropriate too, I think. Eric Foner, who's, the Dean of Reconstruction Studies, in the new introduction to his book, Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, he said that a lot of the issues that Americans are dealing with today are Reconstruction issues. Who is entitled to the rights of citizenship? What are those rights? The 14th Amendment is a big sort of hot button issue right now, and that comes directly from Reconstruction. The idea of immigration today, understanding that, you sort of have to understand the 14th Amendment, that if there's an immigrant from, let's say, Mexico who comes to the United States, and if she should have a baby, if she should have a child, that child, under the terms of the Constitution, is an American citizen. And that goes back to the clause in the 14th Amendment that says anyone who is born in the United States is automatically a citizen. And that comes from the need to grant official citizenship to the former slaves who, under the terms of the Dred Scott decision in 1857, the Supreme Court had said that African Americans were not citizens, had never been meant to be citizens, and had no rights that white people were bound to respect. So the 14th Amendment was what finally established that, and it is still an important issue today. So Eric Foner says that if you want to understand what's going on around you today, you need a solid grasp of what actually happened in Reconstruction.
And I would say that's part of the reason that the Park Service is engaging in this conversation. The Park Service will turn 100 as an agency, born in 1916. And of the 409 sites that we have as a part of our system, there's no site that's dedicated to the conversation or the history of Reconstruction at this point in time. And so to your earlier question, should this come to bear, come to light at some point in the future, that would allow that site, that place, wherever it may be, to be able to then have these conversations of the relativity of Reconstruction to America today.
All right, let's look at what the Park Service has done when it's with many of the sites and the Civil War. You have added new interpretations and new exhibits related to the Civil War to existing sites. For example, in how many national park sites do we have in South Carolina? We've obviously got Fort Sumter, Fort Moultrie.
Well, Fort Sumter, Fort Moultrie is one unit. You have the Charles Pinckney Historic Site as a separate unit. You have Congaree. You have 96, Kings Mountain, and Cowpen, if I didn't leave anybody out.
Okay. Some of those, for example, Fort Sumter, Fort Moultrie, Charleston, military headquarters, talk about, I mean, the troops would be, certainly they would have been garrisoned at Fort Moultrie, federal troops. During Reconstruction.
You're correct, yes, sir.
I'm not sure how you can bring 96 Kings Mountain and Cowpens into that, but they're probably places around the South, many of them military fortifications, that are national parks. I look at Charleston, Avery Institute, the founding of South Carolina State. It really widens the possibilities for bringing this part of our history, which many folks, both black and white actually, but particularly a lot of white Southerners, don't want to talk about.
We realized from our previous engagement in this time period that how do we engage white Southerners in a conversation about Reconstruction when many folks don't believe it ever happened? It's some type of mythical time in our American experience. It was a dark time. It was a bleak time. But it's a reality. Yes, it did occur. Folks on both sides, you know, had challenges, may have suffered in different ways. It did change the economic picture of the South. And so one of the things that we have been discussing and been very open and honest, and I'm willing to say it here, is how do we have this honest dialogue about Reconstruction? Because both you and I and Brett know it occurred.
Gentlemen, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Michael Allen from the National Park Service and Brent Morris from the University of South Carolina at Beaufort about Reconstruction, which is a National Park Service National Heritage Project that's now being studied region-wide in the American South, from Virginia to Texas.
One of the great things that will come from the National Park Service initiative, no matter what the end result actually is education of the general public about what Reconstruction was, what it was about, what it hoped to accomplish. And I think education is really the way to get at rescuing the history of Reconstruction from one of the ways that it's traditionally been remembered, as this terrible dark period of vengeance that these vengeful Yankees came down and punished the South. Education, starting at a very early age and at all different levels after elementary school, I think that's very important to actually get the story out there and have it known. People who are denying possibly that Reconstruction happened, or saying that it was one of these darkest periods in American history, they're drawing their interpretations from long outdated historical works. Historians, we realize that things have a shelf life, that really good works that are accepted in their time, eventually new interpretations arise and take their place. And Reconstruction is one of those things that has the historiography or the way that historians have remembered the past. It's replaced itself several times over when it comes to Reconstruction.
And actually, that's not just the view of white Southerners in the post-Civil War period. Nationally, in terms of history, it got written out of the history books pretty quickly.
It did.
You know, the Great Barbecue, corruption, the carpetbagger, all of this became part of the national historical discussion. Mm. But let's go back and look at 1865, 66, 67. What was the federal government? Let's define Reconstruction. We've got two Reconstructions, and let's sort of walk through those and what goals were and then what actually happened or didn't happen. Brent?
Well, the most important of the Reconstructions was the ideological Reconstruction. The need that the federal government felt that the former Confederates had to have their minds changed, that they had to be convinced that human bondage was not the right thing. It wasn't the most efficient labor system. And morally, it was a terrible thing. They had to sort of be convinced in whatever way that the government would go about it, that white supremacy was not a way to base your society. And these are hard things to deal with.
But now, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. The question of white supremacy, not a whole lot of white folks in the North believed in racial equality.
That is one of the things that kind of united the North and the South, were to at least some degree a degree of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. But the ideological Reconstruction was sort of getting the South rebuilt, literally reconstructed, and getting it rebuilt on a free labor basis. And of course, this started with the Port Royal experiment, but it was going to be what Reconstruction was about.
All right, now we have presidential Reconstruction.
Yes.
Let's explain that. President Andrew Johnson, a white Democrat from Tennessee, with Lincoln's death, he becomes president. All right, let's talk about his Reconstruction and why it didn't fly.
Johnson was came from a very modest Tennessee family. He was put on the ticket in 64 to help Lincoln attract Unionist votes, because Johnson was a Tennessee senator that did not resign his seat after secession. He did not go the way of his state, and he stayed in Washington. So this was a way to reward him for that, but also to attract Unionist votes. Johnson, coming as he did from a modest a non-slave-owning family in Tennessee, was envisioned when he took over from Lincoln as potentially somebody who could really work a radical change in the South. His political career had always sort of situated him against the big landowners, against the big slave owners. And there was a sense that once Johnson sort of instituted his own plan for Reconstruction, that would be continued in the post-war South. What eventually happened was just the opposite of that. Johnson's Reconstruction plan, which he proposed while Congress was at recess, could have potentially been a very radical plan. It disfranchised a lot of former Confederates. It set property limits that people, if you owned a certain amount of property over, I think it was $20,000, you could not hold office or vote under the Reconstruction political system. And Johnson, it seemed at least at first that somebody that might actually be able to forward Lincoln's plans towards the new America, towards this new birth of freedom. Johnson's Reconstruction policies, however, in practice were—he actually called it restoration rather than Reconstruction. He eventually made it very easy for anybody that wanted to apply for a pardon to do so. Johnson overturned a lot of the land redistribution plans, like Sherman's Special Field Order Number 15, which set aside a huge area of land in the Lowcountry for redistribution to freedmen families. And Johnson, basically, in the time period from when he took over the presidency after Abraham Lincoln's death to the time where the 39th Congress actually came into session in late 1865, managed to propose his own plan without congressional approval that made it relatively easy for the states to gain readmission. When the 39th Congress assembled in Washington in December of 1865, it was pretty clear that the interim between Lincoln's death and when this new Congress was coming into session, a lot had happened in the South. Southerners did not appear to have accepted the verdict of the battlefield. They were still just as belligerent as ever. And the people that they sent to Washington to represent them, it was former Confederates, almost to a man. Georgia, for instance, sent Alexander Stevens, who had just, as their congressional representative, who had just a couple of months before been the vice president of the Confederacy. And Congress, of course, makes its own rules. The Speaker of the House refused to seat these new delegates from the South, sent them back home. And at that point, there was the need for a new Reconstruction plan. And Congress got to work on that, which ushered in the era of congressional Reconstruction.
Let's talk a little bit about what the elements were of congressional Reconstruction.
Congressional Reconstruction was a much more radical Reconstruction. It potentially could have been a revolutionary Reconstruction. With Congress sort of leading the way, Andrew Johnson was of course, still president, but was becoming increasingly powerless. Congress was proposing different ways that the states might come in.
Or let's explain, the states coming in.
Yes, okay.
But because they had seceded and their delegations had all resigned or had been expelled, most of them resigned, there was a military occupation, military government instituted under the Reconstruction Act.
Right.
And there was a plan based upon, in order to come back in, you had to have a new constitution, you had to let everybody vote, and then sort of ask to come back in to have your senators and representatives seated.
Right. There was a long process you had to go through, and that included the ratification of the 14th Amendment once that was passed.
The 13th
had to be passed first.
The 13th was, of course, abolishing slavery.
That's correct. And South Carolina, there were constitutional conventions in 1865, right after the war, before radical Reconstruction started. And South Carolina just barely ratified the 13th Amendment. They didn't really nullify their ordinance of secession like they had been required to. And
they passed the Black Codes.
They did pass the Black Codes, which established a whole new legal code that applied only to the freedmen. Certain trades were restricted to only white workers unless the African-American could pay a certain tax. The freedom to move around freely without a pass was taken away. It seemed almost as if it was just the old slave codes with new assumptions that the slaves themselves were not actually property. But the process of readmission in radical Reconstruction or congressional Reconstruction, it was sort of based on the idea that a lot of radicals had in Congress that when the Southern states had seceded, they had actually committed what was called state suicide.
And there were even some folks who talked about redrawing boundaries.
Right, absolutely. And Lincoln had been steadfast when he was alive that in fact secession was illegal, and he never actually acknowledged the fact that the Southern states had seceded in the first place. Lincoln really dealt with the states all throughout the Civil War as almost like misbehaving children that needed to be punished but brought back into the fold. And that didn't really survive him. And a lot of that was because Andrew Johnson was so sort of easy on the Southern states and the terms that he allowed them to be readmitted to the Union. Congress would have none of that. So the terms of readmission of the states under the new congressional plan were much tougher. And they really struck at the center of what a lot of Southerners sort of the way that they define themselves. I mean, the 14th Amendment was what gave citizenship to all people born in the United States. It would have been them offering citizenship to the people who had been their property just a few years earlier, and it was very difficult.
And of course, in places like South Carolina, which is 60% African American,
absolutely,
you have that plus the fact that you have any number of white Carolinians disenfranchised because of their participation in either the Confederate Army or civil office.
That's true. South Carolinians in particular, I mean, the white South Carolinians went to incredible efforts to try to frustrate just about every aspect of radical Reconstruction they could. One of the things that you had to do for readmission was to, like Walter said, call a constitutional convention, draft a brand new constitution, and then later on apply for readmission to the Union. In the lead up to the constitutional convention in South Carolina of 1868, all eligible male voters were asked to register to vote, who could then, the voters would then vote on delegates to the Constitutional Convention, who would then draft the new Constitution. The trick was that if a majority of the state's voters did not vote on calling the Constitutional Convention, it would not go forward. So white voters in large, large numbers registered to vote, but then refused to vote for the calling of a Constitutional Convention, hoping that they could frustrate actually having the Constitutional Convention and drafting the new document in the first place. The convention was successful, and it came about because almost all African-American voters who were eligible came to the polls. I think it was something between 85 and 90%. And just barely a majority of eligible voters voted for the Constitutional Convention, and only those who had voted for the convention were able to serve as delegates. So the delegates to the 1868 Constitutional Convention in South Carolina were, in a large part, African-Americans, for the first time playing a huge role in the development of fundamental law in any state in the South.
The trick in calling the Constitutional Convention, the strategies that Southern states adopted, South Carolina was pretty much unique because of its overwhelming black population.
Right.
But it still came close to, had somehow there not been a majority of the voters do it, there wouldn't have been a Constitutional Convention of 68, which meant that military government would have continued.
Right.
What happened in South Carolina, the 1868 Constitution, which was modeled on Ohio's, did some things that had never happened in South Carolina before. It created a public school system.
For the first time. Yeah, it offered public schooling to all children, black and white. And this is really where the national public school movement comes from. It grows out of South Carolina and sort of spreads outward, and it was there in that 1868 Constitution. Now, that Constitution, it's really unique. Like you said, it was based on the Ohio Constitution. The delegates, especially the African-American delegates to the convention, did not do what a lot of people would assume they would do. They didn't go out of their way to try to institute some sort of, you know, affirmative action system that would be vindictive towards the white Southerners and give them some sort of huge benefit. They attempted, as best they could, to draft a completely colorblind document that would not give any sort of benefits to anyone based on race. And I think that's pretty remarkable. But it didn't matter what the document itself said, that it had been drafted by African Americans and Republicans was all the white Democratic Southerners needed to know to oppose it.
It also established true local government.
It did.
County government. And so briefly, local government really meant something in South Carolina. So 1868, South Carolina's constitution is accepted.
It is.
When do they start letting individuals go back to Congress?
That is 68.
Okay.
It's the first group of elections or the first elections under this new Reconstruction government.
All right. But federal troops are not withdrawn from South Carolina.
They're begun to be drawn down in 1868.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there never were huge numbers. It was in the hundreds. It was not in the tens of thousands, which I sometimes folks say.
Well, there's the sense that as one of the components of that compromise of 1877, that troops were withdrawn from the South, that you're withdrawing entire armies. In fact, it was just, you know, handfuls of troops here and there. It was more of a symbolic withdrawal than anything else.
That's where we get the rub, as has been said, about the study of Reconstruction. What did it do? What didn't it do? And it boils down a lot to racial issues.
And I want to add with that, you know, for me, I try to make this experience personal. And I think when you can do that or connect it to communities, you know, I grew up in King Street in Winsburg County, and I can say now that Lieutenant Swales, Mayor Swales, Senator Pro Tem Swales was not taught to me. I had to become an adult to know Mr. Swales existed in King Street, South Carolina. And I think when we can begin to open these chapters and to talk about the life and legacy of individuals from community and their life and their connectivity to Reconstruction, it's a way I think people can connect with that time.
All right.
But as you all shared earlier, if we keep this in from a mystical perspective, then it's hard to connect people to it.
All right, Michael, Mayor Swales was mayor of Kingstree during Reconstruction.
Yes, you're correct, yes.
If you look at not just Kingstree, Georgetown, Beaufort, Charleston, Columbia, and across the state, except in the 10 white majority districts, or they're now officially counties after 1868. In the upstate, the rest of the counties in South Carolina had black majorities. So
right.
African Americans are figuring very prominently into governmental affairs.
And they do so more in South Carolina than anywhere else. I believe there's a number I'm thinking of. It's between 1867 and 1876. African Americans win more than half of all state and federal elections. there at different times, a majority in the state House of Representatives and in the Senate, African Americans and white Republicans together have a huge majority there for most of Reconstruction. Black politicians are elected to Speaker of the House, Attorney General, Lieutenant Governor, U.S. Congress, and in South Carolina, it's happening more than anywhere else, where African Americans are really using that large black majority that they enjoy in South Carolina and translating that into political power.
Interestingly, though, whereas a few other southern states, I think it was Mississippi and
right,
elected a black U.S. senator, South Carolina never did, and that had partly to do with Republican Party politics in South Carolina.
It did, yeah.
At the time. And also a Supreme Court justice.
That's true.
One of the issues out of Reconstruction that affected higher education was that the University of South Carolina was the only white Southern university to be segregated at the trustee level, at the faculty level, and at the student level. And the stain on the university, as it was called after Reconstruction, was a genesis for creating other institutions.
It was. University of South Carolina had two black trustees named in 1869. Hmm. At that point, a lot of the white students started to withdraw. A lot of the white faculty started to withdraw. African-American students were part of the student body from 1873 on. And from that point through the rest of Reconstruction, the University of South Carolina was roughly 90% African-American.
Yes. Many of the key faculty did withdraw. And in one of the ironies of history, the founders of the graduate school at the University of California at Berkeley were the LeConte brothers, who withdrew from South Carolina and went to California because of the desegregation of the University of South Carolina.
It was for a time a predominantly African-American institution simply because whites refused to go there and to sit in chairs next to African-American students or be taught by an African-American faculty. I mean, Richard Greener was an African-American faculty member at the University of South Carolina, got his law degree while he was there as well. And that was really, again, one of the revolutionary things about Reconstruction was that the University of South Carolina, as part of the public education system, was now opened up to anyone who wanted to go.
But as soon as federal troops were withdrawn, the University of South Carolina was closed.
It was. Not to be opened for a while. When Reconstruction ended in South Carolina and it came into the hands of the Democratic Party, a lot of things changed.
Yeah. Well, why don't we say when congressional reconstruction.
That's right. Federal Reconstruction or congressional Reconstruction. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Michael, can you talk about what's going on in some other places than South Carolina, what the Park Service is experiencing?
You talked about how can you connect Reconstruction to existing Park Service sites. And we do have one of our staffers that's a part of this program that's specifically looking at how we can connect Reconstruction to existing National Park Service sites across the Southeast. One of the things that we've learned, and this is part of, I guess, Heritage as an agency, most National Park Service sites, if they came congressionally, have what we call enabling legislation. And that enabling legislation basically defines what we are to talk about. But when you have a park that perhaps came in the 1920s or 30s or 40s and talking about Reconstruction or African American history as a whole was not probably thought of, then those type of language would not be in the enabling legislation. Nevertheless, as we described earlier, activities happen at sites that was connected to Reconstruction. Case in point, let's go back to Fort Sumter. We know that in April of 1865, at the end of the war, there was a large flag-raising ceremony out at Fort Sumter. We know that Robert Smalls helped to ferry individuals out to Fort Sumter. We know that the son of Denmark Vesey was out at Fort Sumter. We know that Lieutenant Swales, former of the 54th, he was at Fort Sumter. Now, we didn't change the story of Fort Sumter. We just told you about an episode we perhaps had not really discussed in a more open way. And so I think those are some of the things that we're looking at now, is how can we infuse the story of Reconstruction at existing National Park Service sites in which these things did occur within their environment or within their space, and it still helps to enhance the integrity of that site. And so as we are speaking with individuals in other states throughout the Southeast, whether it's a state park or community park or a municipal park, they too are looking at ways of how can they infuse this history as a part of the story that they have not been telling. Now, I would give one great example here in Charleston, McLeod Plantation, which is on James Island, which is managed by Charleston County Park and Recreation Commission. Yes, the story of McLeod Plantation is about, you know, cotton and the Civil War. That's true. But there's another chapter that they're openly discussing. That's the Freedmen's Bureau. And to my knowledge, I'm not sure how many sites around our nation actually interprets that. And so that's another chapter that's a part of the Reconstruction chapter that also needs to be opened up. Because without the Freedmen's Bureau, many of the things that we just discussed about Reconstruction perhaps would not have come to pass. And so I believe that this Reconstruction movement and this journey helps us to really go into some places that need to be discussed, uncover history that needs to be looked at, and it talks about themes and topics that are very relevant to us today.
And, of course, in Charleston, Michael, there will shortly be the International African American Museum. I'm assuming that perhaps the Reconstruction story is going to be part of that?
Well, from my understanding, and I'm involved with the process of that new museum, yes, that vehicle will help to tell that story. And I believe that museums and historic sites, we all have a very important part to play in the discussing, just not of American history, but specifically Reconstruction. That's why I enjoy working with the folks on Hilton Head at Mitchellville and what they're doing to highlight that community, its place, its connectivity, its relevancy, and its importance in not only from a Reconstruction perspective, but in the lives of Gullah Geechee people living on Hilton Head Island and those who sought refuge there.
Brent, I know in Buford, this has been going on for years, there is a reenactment every January the 1st. Mm-hmm. The first place in the South that the Emancipation Proclamation was read in Buford. And that it's done every January the 1st.
That's a great story. It was January the 1st, 1863. The new day was dawning across the nation. The Emancipation Proclamation was becoming law at this point. And the first place that it was read publicly was under a huge oak tree, now called the Emancipation Oak, on the old Smith Plantation, which is now on the grounds of the Naval Hospital in Beaufort. And freedmen from across the county were ferried in. It was at low tide, so they actually had to be, in some cases, carried to where the celebration would be. But an African-American regiment of soldiers was there. Thomas Wentworth Higginson, their officer, the famous Transcendentalist Unitarian minister from New England who had come down to lead these troops. William Henry Brisbane, who was a Beaufort planter, who freed all of his slaves, moved to Ohio, became an abolitionist, and then was brought back to the Lowcountry as a tax commissioner in 1862, was given the honors of reading the Emancipation Proclamation for the first time, and he addressed the huge crowd before him, and he read the words of, he actually read the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation because the text of the actual Emancipation Proclamation did not reach them until about 8 hours later. But he addressed the gathered group there. He saw in the audience actually one of his former slaves who he was not able to free. Just this incredible sort of story come full circle. And a brass band struck up several different tunes, including John Brown's Body. They had 12 oxen that they roasted for a huge barbecue. It was just an incredible festive occasion, but it was amazing in that in South Carolina, you know, the first state out of the Union, the beginning of the Civil War, this would be the first place that the Emancipation Proclamation would be read publicly to an audience of whites and African Americans.
All right, gentlemen, Alfred's giving me the wind-up sign. We need to come to a conclusion here. So, Michael Allen, any last words you have for our listeners today?
You know, again, this is a new chapter for me. Being involved with this Reconstruction journey, you know, I have 35 years under my belt working with the National Park Service and have been fortunate and blessed to be, I guess, on the cusp of a lot of good activities and events and movements. And I see this as probably one of the most challenging that I've ever been involved with, but also just as rewarding as the others, because at the end of the day, this is about our American experience, our American history, thread in our American quilt.
Okay. Brent?
Shelby Foote in Ken Burns' Civil War documentary series said that the Civil War is the crossroads of our being. A lot of people think that, but I would offer that Reconstruction is, in fact, the crossroads of America's being. It was the first opportunity that America really had to bring itself into line with its founding ideologies, with those words from the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This was the chance following this catastrophic Civil War for the United States government to actually, like I said, bring itself into line with its founding ideologies, to become consistent with itself. And it set very high goals. Goals were not necessarily reached, but in the words of W.E. Du Bois, it was a splendid failure. It was a start towards something truly revolutionary. And the ideas of Reconstruction, the ideas of the Declaration of Independence through Reconstruction, never really died. They stuck around, and they were resurrected in what people call the Second Reconstruction and the Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and 1960s. And we're still dealing with a lot of the ideas of Reconstruction today. So this is a very important period of our history that I think a much more thorough understanding of by most Americans will benefit them greatly.
All right. Thank you both. Michael Allen with the National Park Service and Brent Morris, professor at USC Buford. Thank you both, gentlemen, for being with us today on The Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. Reconstruction is not an easy period to discuss with many folks, even in the 21st century, whether you're white or black or from the North or from the South. It's a frequently misunderstood period, but it was, as Professor Morris pointed out, when the country had to come to grips with its founding ideals without regard to race, religion, or national origin, that all men are created free. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.